Hi everyone, I'm Joe. I'm here with Luke. We're on to talk about a topic that came up in the Discord server. This is something that we've discussed in the Sacramento meetup quite a few times, and we just kind of wanted to share it with the group. The basic premise of this is that modern progressives are acting similarly to how stereotypical conservatives of the past acted. And the big change, or the big kind of thing that I wanted to bring to the table, is I think this is actually a personality trait that's innate in them, because now we have people who otherwise would be conservative aligned or traditionally aligned are now conserving the culture that's given to them both by their families, so their parents, the society at large, and by media at large. And so when that happens, essentially what I'm saying is that we've had this generational shift where it's the people who are closed-minded and probably more direct in their thinking, so they see a problem, they want to offer the first solution, and then they want to implement that first solution, are now the people that are pushing what previously had been the more open-minded branches of both political thought and social thought.
Yeah, so I've thought a lot about this topic. I tend to be politically averse because, and I maybe mentioned this to you, but I think I see politics as the modern American secular religion. And I saw a clever turn of phrase once that just said, you know, because Marx is known as religion is the opiate of the masses, but then when you combine those two, I would say politics is now the opiate of the masses. And so what I see, I would agree with your general outlook. And it's interesting to think about it in terms of conservative and liberal temperament. And I think I got into this stuff with Jordan Peterson, and Jonathan Haidt was one of my big influences in this. So I want to bring in Haidt and also Orwell, because what I see happening is essentially what I call what Orwell called double speak, where you are, or even Peugeot talks about the inverted world. And so a lot of times people do what I would say is a conservative impulse, where they, in Haidt's terms, they react to the other or the person they don't like with a disgust factor. And you can do that as what is commonly in the common parlance of today known as like a political conservative, like pick whomever you want. And, you know, and they're disgusted by liberals, and liberals are disgusted by conservatives, and they mock each other and make fun of each other and rarely have, really empathetic, well thought out, charitable discussions with one another. And they essentially scapegoat. And then, but what that is, what's interesting is like one of them is labeled conservative and one of them is labeled liberal. But like that term liberal has just been hijacked and it's been flipped upside down and it's lost all its meaning, because really liberal, both temperamentally and classically, is meant to be tolerant. I mean, you're open-minded. You're okay with people doing whatever they want. Essentially, you know, live and let live somewhat. I mean, politically now, the only thing that's even really close to that is like libertarianism or anarchism, essentially, to like what traditional liberalism was. But now modern liberalism is just, I always call them conservatives in sheep's clothing. They're just conservatives with different values, but they react to the official conservatives with disgust and the same kind of puritanical animosity.
I mean, it's the same kind of tribalism that you see them accusing other people of, is they're ready to hop into it immediately. Now, they claim that they're doing it based off of different criteria. Is that always true? Not really, because they do the same moves that other people do. They judge people by the color of their skin. They judge people by their genitals. They judge people by their age. They judge people by whatever XYZ factor it is. And usually they just reserve those judgments for somebody who disagrees with them on some other part of their orthodoxy. So if you disagree with somebody on their language, or you disagree with somebody on their position on a certain thing, I don't want to actually get too far into politics directly. I kind of want to talk about social causes, but we can see this happening when there's that visceral gut reaction to somebody who has a minor difference in opinion compared to you.
Yeah.
And, I guess to get more into the conversation, it's like, where do we go with that? How do we provide an outlet for people to not get caught into those conversations? And like, what then are those people called? Besides, as I think you were kind of alluding to before, it looks like people who lean towards anarchy or libertarian movements kind of have that open-minded freedom or liberty push. It's so hard to talk about these terms even today because they've been so abused.
No, for sure. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's hard. So I agree. I don't want to talk about politics because I think politics muddies the waters, because I really do think it's somewhat the opiate of the masses and the religion that everyone adheres to, that everybody's so passionate about that they lose any ability to have much of a meaningful conversation about it, because it gets so close to the top of their value hierarchy, because that's how they see implementing their, you know, their utopia, I guess, which is interesting. That reminds me of an old Paul video with that. Who was that? That filmmaker from, was he from South Africa that talked about utopianism?
Don't remember that one.
Oh man. It was a good one.
We end up having a lot of people, come into these conversations, and immediately what they want to lean towards is talking about utopian ideals. And part of that's fun because, you know, it's the big picture thinking that I guess is kind of needed in a way. You have to at least be able to think in utopianism before you pare it down and get more realistic. But it's also not good because it leads to analysis paralysis. You know, it leads to where you get stuck doing nothing. I think too that what you're talking about is where they're talking, where it immediately ends up, conversations immediately end up where it feels like people are getting attacked at the top of their value hierarchy. I think it doesn't seem like that's by accident. It seems like a lot of that's by design. It seems like a lot of the rhetoric that's surrounded politics, the rhetoric that's surrounded media in a saturated market, And so I'm going to make that distinct from the old markets where there was room for more media. I'm saying now there's more media than there is room to consume it. So now it's so saturated that what gets the most attention is the stuff that's the loudest and the angriest.
Yeah.
And that's not a partisan phenomena. It's definitely a bipartisan phenomena.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, and that's all driven by, with the media, you know, people say that it's, what is it, multi-billion-dollar industry. And so that's all driven by making money, keeping, you know, I don't even know if this is right, but I think your amygdala inflamed so that you're not actually thinking, you're not actually engaging. We're not actually, again, it's Orwellian, because we're proclaiming that we're all rational and we're debating these things and we're having talking points and we're debating these issues back and forth, but you're doing it in a way that inhibits your rationality from functioning even the way that it should be. And so so I guess for me to be able to speak about this most from where I know in my experience, the way that I've seen this happen, because really I think this is a spiritual thing that happens in all sorts of forums. I mean, it happens in socially, it happens politically, it happens religiously, it happens at the church level. And so this is how I've seen it happen at the church level. And this is, I talked about this with Paul in my first talk with him, but I grew up in more conservative leaning evangelical churches. And I always used to say I came to realize that when you set up your church in a certain structure, which is interesting because Paul was talking about like propositional in his video today, which I don't know if you saw, where he was reviewing Mark Vernon's book on Barfield. He was talking about how people complain that Christians set, you know, they have all these propositional statements that are binding, but he says that's what everybody's doing. You know, like you were just saying before, everybody's got their orthodoxies and they define things around and who's in and who's out. But what I saw at my church and what I always said is that you define, like, say, theoretically, because this is how my church was, one of my older churches, that you go to a church that has a statement of faith. This church, for instance, had like three statements, propositions that we believe and we affirm. Mm-hmm. and we think these things are core to us functioning. The problem was, at like, what came up for me practically is there was one of those statements that I couldn't affirm in good conscience because I didn't agree with it. And I mean, so this gets into interesting topics of like what that does. And I think it's, I mean, you see this happening on Paul's channel, but also what happened in our churches. I think what I came to realize afterwards is what you're doing is there's a couple interesting things happening, because I would argue that all the people that go to that church may or may not affirm all those things and believe those things. I mean, how many people even take those things that seriously and are really parsing them through and paying attention and looking at them?
How many people parse anything through? It's like,
right. And so then that's, so really my basic outlook, or my theory on that, is that what you're doing is you're basically establishing a system that is only drawing in people of a certain temperament, which is conservative and of a certain bent. And so then, but what happens is I think that people that tend to be, that can be a little bit more liberal sometimes, like this is what I see happening in the phenomenon within evangelicalism, with like, you get the conservatives and then you get the progressives over here. And the progressives most of the time are disenfranchised conservatives, like of another generation. And so they'll have grown up in this church, and for some reason there was something that they didn't mesh with, didn't do. They went out from them, and then they established their own thing. But they established this other now progressive tribe that's in the exact same spirit of the initial tribe. And I think that's what you have happening at every level. I mean, that's what's happening in churches. That's what's happening in politics. That's what's happening. And then they just talk past each other. And so I think what we need to do, and this is something that's been talked about a lot through like the Rogan talks about this, long form conversations, podcast, Paul, like this is what Paul, I think, does a really good job with, like even talking to, for instance, Samuel the other day, you know, the non-Trinitarian evangelical.
Yep.
I think that you have to have a space where you can have dialogue with people that don't fit into your orthodoxy without scapegoating and demonizing them, or else I think we're inevitably stuck in this unending conservative or veiled conservative reactionary ideological disgust reaction.
So there was something you said quick there of disenfranchised conservatives going off and forming their own church in the same, did you use the word vein or same?
Same spirit or okay. Vein. Yeah. Like the same attitude. It's just, I think they just end up holding other values. So like, this is why I call
the attitude being like the culture of leadership, or the attitude being what?
Essentially this whole idea of like what we're talking about of establishing their own orthodoxy, their own in-group and out-group based on just different criteria, and usually revolving around whatever issue it was that got them excluded from their previous in-group. I mean, that's what Protestantism is. Like, that's what's always happened, you know? Like, they just, or any church. I mean, I don't want to just say Protestantism, but it's most obvious in Protestantism.
Yeah.
Is, you know, you have this group, there's a disagreement, so then that person goes off and establishes their own new orthodoxy, but it's centered around the idea of whatever the disagreement was.
So what happens, I guess, the point we're at now in a lot of the more social, the less church-based stuff is what happens when the original excluding organization or system, or however you want to phrase it, then becomes tolerant of the people that previously they were intolerant of. Because it's really hard to not to grasp the arguments. I understand the arguments, but the math doesn't play out on that. Like women are some exponentially excluded class compared to like men in different parts of society. Like in certain individual structures, there's still the old kind of ways of doing things, but it's hard to find the specific. It would be really hard to argue that things haven't gotten any better than they were 80 years ago or 100 years ago in most of these respects. And now I see even the people who previously were who were stereotyped, maybe accurately stereotyped, as being intolerant, now being tolerant of these groups. But the groups that they're that previously they had this that previously were excluded are now doubling down on their insistence that they're being excluded against or
So without pushing you into like getting really specific and triggering people with your mansplaining patriarchy, I mean, it seemed like you brought up egalitarian issues,
yeah,
and the feminist movement and equality issues, mm-hmm, in those regards, however you conceive of those things, which equality
can be. They're super rough statements because they've been so abused.
And it's a word that fudges. Like, what is equality? Is it, yeah. I mean, I think most people think of equality as sameness, which I think is an insane way to think about it.
Yeah, ends up being oppressive in its own right because people are different and have different desires just to start with, and they're going to act those out in the world.
Right. So what you're essentially saying, I'm just going to repeat it back to you and tell me if you're right, and sorry if this puts you in the hot water, I guess. I mean, it just is what it is. So, like, previously, society was more misogynistic to whatever degree, more patriarchal, for lack of a better term. I tend to think societies are all patriarchal and matriarchal, and it's fluid, and it's whatever. I don't even like it when people say that. But anyhow, it was, and now it's moving more this direction where, I mean, whatever measure of equality you want to say, like similar wage earning, women in the workforce, women not being tied to childbirth and being at home and all that.
College attendance rates, life expectancy, like all these different
right.
things. Like
all those things are happening. Like what
not
they
perfectly equal, but
right. What they profess to want toward equality.
Yeah.
But yet it doesn't seem like, but it seems like they're even, or some people are even more upset. Like they don't feel, it's almost like that has been meaningless and like they want more, which is not to say like there can't be more that's done, but it's just like the anger and the zeal has not been abated whatsoever.
It's yeah. The anger and zeal has doubled, or, you know, it's at least in the last decade, at least since social media has become very popular. I mean, it would be hard to argue that things are so much better than they were in 2005. The only real big civil society change that I've seen since 2005 was the legalization of, or nationalization of, gay marriage. Other than that, most of the fundamentals of society haven't changed that much. But I don't, it, the way we hear about it, the way it's talked about, the way it's portrayed, it sounds as if since 2005 to 2000, almost 2020, it sounds as if everything has gotten 10 times worse. I can't work that math out. I've tried working that math out. It doesn't make any sense.
And I mean, what you're saying makes sense to me. So then what would you say is going on? If you would, so I mean, it seems like what we're saying is that things have improved. There's a fairly obvious trajectory, you know, that you can establish through a number of levels of analysis and metrics, but yet that, and so people are getting what they're asking for to some degree, even if it's not complete, all these, you know, qualifications, but yet they're even more upset. So what does that mean? What's that telling you?
And it seems it's what that tells me. And because it's good to talk this out, because I haven't talked this out directly with a lot of people. It's always just great to, you know, you have to verbalize your thoughts to get them straight in your head sometimes.
For sure.
So to me, what it seems like is that there's been a huge movement away from tolerance and a huge movement towards affirmation. And the problem with affirmation is everyone wants to feel affirmed. Everyone wants their identity or their, even more so than their identity, their preferences and their modes of being affirmed, to say, yes, you're doing the right thing. Yes, you are the right kind of person. You are the right kind of thing. But the problem with that is that it requires two people. tolerance requires two people to mutually agree that they're not going to interfere with each other. Where affirmation requires the person who needs affirming to request or demand the affirmation from the other group.
Right. So this is essentially like, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but from my understanding, what you're essentially saying is the difference between positive and negative rights. So like negative rights is essentially the right to be left alone, mm-hmm. which is somewhat tolerance. Like, just leave me alone. Mm-hmm. I do me, you do you. And then a positive right is something that requires something of someone else, like universal health care.
Yeah.
It requires action on your part. It's not just that you leave me alone. Like I'm, like you were saying, in affirmation, I need you to verbally say you agree with me. Like even with, you know, Jordan Peterson, pronoun use, it's not so much that like you just leave me alone and live my own life. Like you have to use the words I tell you to use.
And he's repeatedly said that within reason, if they're being done, not for manipulative purposes, but for just common courtesy purposes, he will go along with those when he thinks he's not trying to be manipulated. But when people are coming at him to do an Orwellian kind of play or Machiavellian Orwellian, however you want to I can see that concern. I can see where that comes from. That's one of my pet peeves as well, as I hate when people are trying to force me into some corner through some kind of what I perceive to be trickery. And
right. Well, yeah. I mean, no one likes to be manipulated. And so, I mean, but it seems like to me what's happening then. So with negative rights or like say tolerance, mm-hmm. you're basically saying, don't control me. But with a positive right, so the control is all within the individual. Like you can't control me externally, I control myself. But with a positive right, it's demanding, you're wanting to control someone else.
Yes, like to use their terms even, oppression is when you force somebody else to do something. Autonomy would be separating those bonds so that both the person who previously was forcing and the person who was previously forced now have autonomy, and their rights consist of them not interfering with each other as much as is possible. The opposite of that is, it's not even the opposite. It's just going back to the other thing. It's just switching the players. It's now one group of people is forcing another group of people to do something. There could be arguments made that from a utilitarian perspective, it's like, okay, the famous libertarian one is roads. It's like, okay, who could build roads? And like, I hope we don't get any libertarians start flaming us after this, because they like talking about their roads. But
you're fired up. Yeah.
But let's say that we decided roads are necessary. We decided a standing army is necessary. We decided like all these other things are necessary eventually. If you take the boundaries off of that, then suddenly everything becomes quote unquote necessary, and you're in the same position as if you were under a tyrant that the government wasn't doing anything, but some other person was controlling everything, like slavery. It wouldn't be that different, or it would be different in terms of percentage, but not in terms of the raw underlying moral wrongness, or at least the moral impositions, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the problem in modern society that this gets into is that everything is so big and interconnected and globalized, mm-hmm. that there's no, because like even what you were saying, as long as this is essentially a debate, and to bring in, just because it's the easiest for illustration, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to necessarily talk politics, but I mean, the principles and the philosophy is the same. It's essentially a debate between federalism and states' rights, more or less, because if you establish at a state level at a local level, I mean, this gets into political theories that I like, which is like volunteerism. Like if you have a community of people who all agree on something, well then, and you establish some kind of contractual agreement that like, this is, we all agree and we're going to come together collectively to make these decisions, then all those things can be done collectively and non-coercively.
Yes.
Because people are volunteering into it. But when you move outside of those systems and you start to globalize things and things become, mm-hmm. I mean, this gets into very
and
Paul Van der Kleist.
And it's based on 50% plus one.
Right, right. Which my favorite definition of democracy was always like, we're two idiots outrule a genius.
Yeah.
That's what democracy is. But it's a, because some of my, so just to put my cards on the table, fundamentally, and this isn't just politics, it's everything. There's a few principles and ideas that I believe in that ultimately for me are theological. I believe in complete non-coercion. Unilaterally, because I think that's how God is, and I think we're the icon of God, and that's our call, and I think that's how Christ operated. And because ultimately I think the ultimate ideal is love, and I don't, and you can't, love is completely uncontrolled and uncoerced. Otherwise it's not love. I mean, you can't make anyone love you. I mean, it's just not, that's not how it works. There's a great old country song that just popped into my head. I usually think in song lyrics. This is the problem that to get back to our broader thing, this is the problem that I see in church and communities and politically and everything, is that people want to use
I think the theme
or law or anything to control other people.
I think the theme that we're both kind of alluding to too is what's oppressive is the universalization of things.
It necessarily inhibits freedom.
Yeah. So I guess going back to our original kind of the original challenge is the universalization of rules and politics, whatever, church politics or politics, is that a conservative trait or is that it's hard to say it's a liberal trait. Is it a progressive trait? Is it a liberal trait? Is it a...
So I think fundamentally broad, like symbolically at the base level, that's a...
An order trait?
Yeah, an order trait, which I would equate with conservatism. Mm-hmm. But this is why I call, like what we were talking about, the modern day liberals or progressives as mm-hmm. conservatives in sheep's clothing, because they're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Like they want order and control. And so that's, I mean, I don't care what you call yourself, that's an order conservative impulse. Because really to me, what the opposite of that is, and there's a lot of diversity within anarchy, so it's not, but it's completely lawless, reckless, absurdist, a complete loss of hierarchy, anarchy, which mm-hmm. is revolution and chaos. That's the other end of it.
And we all know, like, the way anarchy breaks down right away is hierarchies establish themselves almost immediately. Like,
right.
They're just based right. on new methods of scorekeeping, usually.
Right. And I get to give a shout out. I often call myself an anarchist, and I am of some sort. I'm not that kind of an anarchist, yeah. But I'm the kind of anarchist that's a volunteerist and believes in complete non-coercion.
Yeah. Okay.
So
where were we? We lost ourselves again.
So then I guess I think to get practical and pragmatic, it's like, well then, cause all of this is the abstract theorizing, right? So then, like, what is the means? I mean, this is where I would be inclined to take it, is what is the means? How do we, if everything is moving toward, if both sides are moving to these two extreme orders that are just fighting each other, which I think then eventually, like, this is the idea of, I think, Babel, is like you'll have this fighting and it eventually will devolve into a, in order for balance, it will
too much order that doesn't fit together, too much incompatible order.
Yeah, it will have a resurgence. It's like the Taoist symbol of the yin and the yang. I mean, you'll have a blow up of chaos. That's what will happen, and that's when civilizations fall. That's what war is, I think.
And I think that's kind of an eternal theme. I feel like people are always nervous about that, whether or not it's actually coming. Like, but it does come.
Well, this is the thing that people, and I don't know if this is this Pinker thing, but it seems like that's the, so this is a discussion we could get into. I feel like there's a lot of people out there. I feel like people kind of talk out of both sides of their mouth. I hear a lot of people saying, like, essentially we're past war. Like, we're just not going to do that anymore.
I think we've got one more good one left in us. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. But this is kind of what people always thought, like World War One, World War Two. You know, it's like the war to end all wars, right?
I think on a chemical level, the difference is nuclear. Like the difference is nuclear and fusion weapons. It's like we have the ability to destroy all life on the planet, and it's not going to happen through global warming. It's going to happen through nuclear war if it happens.
Yeah.
Global warming is chemically, like the science behind it, I believe in it, but the science behind it is it's chemically impossible for it to destroy all life on the planet. Like, it's just not going to happen. The even if you take the worst order effects, it's going to destroy life in huge areas. It could be devastating, but like even the worst of climate prediction models can't say that the world is just going to become dead. Maybe it's only cockroaches. Maybe all humans are dead. I don't even think that's possible within current carbon models, but it can't be the apocalypse that they want it to be.
No matter what, it's a fuzzy thought.
Yeah. The reason I bring that up is that's as a comparison to nuclear destruction, which is a scientifically accurate form of destruction that could kill all life on the planet.
Yeah. So it's how do we prevent that? Because I really don't see the answer coming through. I don't know, through I'm just not a top down guy. Maybe that speaks more to my temperament. Either politically or through the church. I mean, this is where I would say, I mean, my answer would be, and I don't even think this happens through ideology. It's not even something that I can promulgate through this video. I think the answer is self-giving, self-sacrificial love that doesn't insist on its own way. I think that's how you change the world.
I like it. I mean, I'm of the same prescription that I think it's building small communities and, you know, being the person you want to be, and then concentric circles of expanding that out. And
I think it's hard. That's the problem with it, is that it's really hard. Like someone said on the Discord the other day, like a lot of people, this is why even like we were talking about before we started recording, like really esoteric philosophical discussions or parsing out the finer points of theology and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's really attractive because it gives you, I don't know. It's almost like a, I don't know what you ever call it, like a dopamine hit or something. Like, it makes you feel like you're doing something.
Yeah.
Without actually doing something, like actually being a saint, actually embodying those things, actually, like I'm dealing with this right now with my kids. I'm having some real struggles with my kids. And like, it's really like, even with my wife, this is the thing. It's always easier to talk about, like after the fact with my wife, you can talk about it all and things seem relatively clear. But really when coming down to the practice, like I'm at a point where with certain kids, it's just like, I don't know how to fix this thing beyond, in a sense, just relinquishing the control, and not in this weird kind of enabling way where I'm just going to let you do whatever you want, but like, I don't know, not insisting on your own way, because things come to a head with people. And like, this is why family, I always liked in these really practical discussions, I always like to ultimately get to family, because that's where I feel like things are most real. Because those are the relationships where we really know each other, and the principles that happen at the family level are the same, you know, they're just scaled socially and politically and globally. And everyone, you know, most people have very dysfunctional families that, you know, with it, essentially like they may live together, but everyone hates each other. And then we're just like, why is our country in shambles? You know? And then the question becomes like, so it's this not insisting on your own way, self-giving, starting local with yourself, cleaning your own room, concentric mm-hmm. circles out. How do we do that and not just talk about it?
I mean, I think a big part of that is essentially by example is, and I think that in order to make something non-coercive too, you have to willingly make it an attractive enough option for people to join willingly. There's been tons. I go back to the Pepsi and Coke example all the time. They spend billions of dollars a year re-advertising sugar water to people who are already addicted to sugar water. And it works. There's a reason that they do it. And so like we can't, I don't think we can get like above the fray where we're just looking down on people and trying to make these little judgments. We have to participate in it. So I'm trying to through my personal life and then through this kind of Discord life, I'm trying to create environments where people can be the good people that they want to be. And that sometimes that means keeping things separate. Sometimes that means bringing things together. I go back to the tolerance thing again. I go back to, part of the acceptance, part of what people are trying to trigger with their forced acceptance or the tool that they're using to force acceptance is a better way of putting it, is provoking anxiety. This is a crisis. That's a crisis. Yeah. This is a crisis. Even us, we did it. We're calling it the meaning crisis. Crisis, crisis, right. Crisis. Anxiety, anxiety, anxiety. Watch out for this. Oh, I'm poking you with that exact thing I told you to walk out. Watch out for it. It's on the individual psychological level, I think it's hugely destructive. And so I think part of it too is getting people to practice some form of abstinence. Like abstinence got turned into such a dirty word because people thought it was being used in a purely sexual manner inappropriately. Yeah. But there's something to be said for the discipline of not doing something. There's something to be said for the difficulty to abstain from junk food, to abstain from alcoholism. Like, because I'm going to take it to the extreme, to abstain from overeating, to abstain from alcoholism, to abstain from drug abuse, to abstain from sexual dysfunction, like to abstain from all these different things, it gives you a lot more power over your own life. And then when you encounter those challenges in your day-to-day life, so like even bringing it back to the family, it's like, I'm sure you get into more arguments with your wife when you haven't slept enough. I'm sure your children are a little bit harder to manage when they're over-caffeinated. Like, yeah. It's all these little things that if you set your environment up correctly, the analogy of a garden works really well here, because you have to set the environment up correctly and then it exists and it maintains itself and it grows on its own, but you're doing both the big work of setting it up and the little work of maintaining it. And that's kind of the beautiful in between, I think.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good word. And then it becomes, I don't know, not, then that kind of influence, like we were talking, the difference between coercion and being compelling or wooing is in that sense, is that instead of then with your kids, to make it practical and relational with that, is if you've set up your garden really well with your kids and your plants, your influence to lead to their flourishing is almost indirect, because you've built it into the whole thing versus the fast and undisciplined and expedient, like, don't do that. Don't do that. Do this. Like, it's a
long-term thinking.
It's short-term. It's passive in the moment, but very active in the bigger scope, very intentional in the bigger scope. And that takes a lot of, and I agree, this is where the abstinence thing is good, and because that's what lends to discipline. And I think that's what, I don't know, I'm the older I get, the more convinced I am of that too. And me and my wife talk about it for years and years and years, and then eventually we start doing it slowly, because it's hard. It's hard to say no to things, because there's so many good things, and there's so many seemingly necessary things. But even like on the Discord server, on the practical one channel, whatever it is, something I'm trying to do is just like have periods of quiet for a day. I think a lot of the monastic disciplines, are having a resurgence, because like you were saying before, like we're just with the internet or with media or with any, we're inundated with content, with information, with impulse.
There's a reason yoga's becoming more and more popular, and there's not a whole lot of difference between many forms of prayer and many forms of meditation.
Yeah. No, right. No, I think that's true. And I think that's like those kinds of disciplines we've lost. And I think it's just another way that I think technology or any has disconnected us from the world. Like that's a very common thing that's discussed in these things, is it, you exchange it. It's the Odin, you know, exchanging his eye for control. That's what we've done with technology for expediency. We've exchanged control in this mechanistic transactional way, but then it's divorced us from the world so that we feel crazy.
Yeah.
And I think the way that we can reverse that is, and it's hard, people struggle with prayer. And a lot of that's probably because people haven't been taught to pray. Like even what you just said, like a lot of, just stillness or quiet or meditation. I mean, a lot of that is prayer. I think people struggle with prayer because they have a really specific thing in their mind that they think they need to be doing, which is probably, which I always equate.
Sometimes it's told to them. Yeah. It's not even their fault.
Right. Or that's just what they see with experience. Like how I grew up with prayer is it's spontaneous. It's not anything rote, because that's then disingenuous. Right. And then there's a whole lot of repeated things, which I always started to think was absurd later, because you'd say, Lord, Jesus, we just, and I'm like, who, when you're talking to him, do you just repeat their name over and over and over?
Like gotta keep interesting, make them pay attention.
I don't know. It's a weird tick that I think cultures have, but
I think it's also a thing. That's the verbal icon that they're trying to use to reaffirm what they're focusing on. And so when they say the same thing over and over and over, it's like, refocus, look away, refocus. And then
it's like the prayer, it's like a prayer mantra.
Yeah, exactly. The intensity gets higher and higher every time they say it. And then, you know, at the end, they've focus so hard on the single word, which is a word that they use in place of an idea. So they focus so hard on that idea that by the end, then you get the little mental hit of, oh yeah, I just did something. and I don't even mean that, like, I don't mean that as an insult. I mean that as an effective tool. It's a little bit of a divergent tool of what's the purpose originally was, but it's effective.
And obviously. Right. And that's probably the point of that's essentially something that me and friends have talked about, but ritualistic knowing, like that's what the ritual does. It puts your body or the tone or the mantra in a state where, yeah, that's part of the whole process. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, do you think that we, do you think this kind of topic within the discussions is an issue within the Paul Vanderclay world, like on the Discord? Do you see these issues popping up?
Issue being,
like the broad conservatism, liberalism, and like all this topic that we've been broadly discussing, and how they're probably both conservative impulses, but really then it's just a controlling tribalism.
I mean, that's going to emerge, the group, cause Paul's channel is so small at the time. So like I could get in contact with like Jordan Peterson. Like I could try and advertise our Discord via Jordan Peterson. It would be too large of an audience. It's not,
sure.
Not self-reflective enough. So I don't even have a desire for him to notice that we're doing something outside of his name, but kind of there.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, that would be the whole universalizing thing anyhow.
That's too much. I do want to grow. I want to grow slowly. I want to grow with the right people. I want to grow with some pre-sorted people so that the management costs, you know, the cost of my time and other people's time is as small as possible. But I think so far, it might be that we're too monocultured. It might be that everyone's a little too interested in how Paul talks and what Paul talks about, that we can't grow effectively. But that doesn't mean that we can't exist.
Yeah.
So maybe 300, you know, we're at 350 people right now. Maybe 500 is the max. Maybe then after 500, people start dropping off and we drop down to 300. And then 300 is the number that we just stay at and we have people leave and come in. 300 people is a community. 300 people is probably two communities. Like, I think there's that number, the 150 number of how many people you can actually know at a time. And anything beyond that, you start dehumanizing the people. Like, they break down and they become objects instead of humans. And I think that's probably true. So the other thing that I am trying to focus on is the whole idea of bridges and nodes. So we have the main public server. It's been more successful than I thought it was going to be this quickly. And then I'm trying to break it off into all these little different special interest groups. So kind of the more clean your room, self-help-ish server, effective habits and stuff like that, which it's kind of a hobby of mine. I enjoy that. The writing server, now we have a family-friendly media server.
Yeah,
these are cool little communities that can form on their own and do their own thing, and they might not look like this discussion that we're having. They might look completely different. They might not have any discussions at all, but they do some other kind of interactions, which is cool. And I'll be tolerant of them. I have no interest in a family-friendly media server. There's nothing for me there, but I'm going to help them. I'm going to help them get in touch with people. I'm going to help the people who want to find that. And I think if does this scale, does that motive being that I want to do scale? I don't know, but hopefully, and hopefully that's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah. I don't see why it shouldn't scale. I mean, it allows people to follow their, you know, call it what you will, their honest inner man, their muse, their salience in an authentic way versus trying to, you know, be pigeonholed into some.
Can we bring the openness? Can we bring the adventure without bringing the anxiety and the exploitation?
Yeah.
Can we at least do a better job of what's being done currently? I think we can definitely do the latter. I'm not sure if we can be the idealistic no manipulation, because we're going to have to lead this thing.
Well, I don't know that it's not manipulation, but it's not, I mean, you could, I don't know. I would say, I would hope.
I said exploitation and anxiety was what I was saying. So like, there's going to be manipulation. Like we have to be the guard. But can we do it without being specifically exploitive? And can we do it without, can one of the tools we use to manipulate people not be anxiety? Cause like, that's where I think why is the modern world making everyone unhappy for no reason? That seems mean. It just seems cruel. So.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, and that's a big thing that's on my heart, is just whatever kind of format can create an environment for people to be. This is something Job and I have talked a lot about, and most people. Like, if I had to pick out like my North Star, what I try to be, and I mean, I'm obviously not claiming to be perfect at this, but it's honesty. And so if you can create an environment where people, in whatever way they want to express that and with whatever gifts and interests they have, to authentically and honestly express themselves and interact with other people, I mean, that seems like a good thing.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to close out this convo, man.
Right.
I'll talk to you soon.
Cool. Sound good.